I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. We'll begin today with a conversation about the horrific events that took place in Charlottesville, Virginia, over the weekend. One woman and two Virginia state troopers are dead, many are injured, and brazenness about racist and hateful rhetoric is alive and well. White nationalists succeeded in shining a bright spotlight on themselves in Charlottesville. The President of the United States has said little to dim that light, drawing severe criticism from, as he might say, many, many sides. Dr. Nathan Connolly, professor of history at Johns Hopkins University, joins me to reflect. Then, Kevin Quinn, the acting administrator of the MTA, Samuel Jordan of the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition, and city planner Klaus Philipson join me for a look at the Link, Baltimore Link. How is Charm City's new bus system working 2 months after its launch? Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. The Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis, and white supremacists have once again taken center stage. In a horrifying display of domestic terrorism, a young racist slammed his car into a crowd of people who had gathered to protest the likes of David Duke, Richard Spencer, and others who had converged on Charlottesville, Virginia, from across the country to spew vitriol and incite violence against people of color and Jews. He killed one woman, Heather Heyer, and injured dozens more. Two Virginia state troopers were killed when their helicopter crashed while observing the demonstrations. The New York Times reports that President Trump consulted with several of his advisors before making a statement on Saturday afternoon, in which he pointedly did not condemn the terrorists, choosing rather to suggest an equivalency between their actions and the actions of those who took to the streets to oppose them. This morning, he directed disparaging remarks about the African-American CEO of Merck Pharmaceuticals, who resigned from the president's manufacturing council. Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun reports this morning that Mayor Catherine Pugh has committed to removing four Confederate monuments in Bolton Hill and Charles Village. Yesterday, protesters gathered in Wyman Park, the site of one of the monuments, to demand their removal, and City Councilman Brandon Scott has promised to introduce a bill in the council tonight to push that effort forward. We'll be speaking with Councilman Scott on tomorrow's edition of Midday. Later in our program today, we will proceed with our plan to discuss the new bus system in Baltimore, known as Baltimore Link. But first here on Midday, reactions and observations about what happened this weekend with Professor Nathan Connolly. He's an historian at Johns Hopkins University who joins us on the phone. Professor Connolly, thank you for your time, sir.
Hi, thank you. Good morning.
So, what are your sort of first thoughts as you view what happened in Charlottesville on Friday night and Saturday, the president's reaction and the reaction to the president?
Well, I think the place of the protest is obviously significant. Charlottesville, Virginia, is a real epicenter for intellectual life in America, the campus of the University of Virginia. The monuments that are there representing a very elite form of Southern politics, generals and professors. It really is a landscape of Southern elites. And so the first thing that really comes to mind is thinking in very kind of hard terms about the class dynamics of these protests. This is not about people who are on the margins of the economic system. These are not the kinds of people who are the dispossessed. These are relatively middle-class, well-educated individuals who are actually adopting a history of very well-educated, middle-class folk who believe in principles of white supremacy. So the first thing that I tend to think about when I see a protest in an elite space like Charlottesville, Virginia, is that this is a longer history of elite racist politics. Relative to the utterances by the president in response to the unrest, it's actually, you know, quite common to find major political figures drawing equivalencies between what they perceive to be a kind of radical leftist position on racial progress and what most consider to be a kind of conservative or reactionary or racist position on the right, relative particularly to white supremacy. And so for him to say that there is violence or vitriol or hatred on many sides is actually not all that different thematically from a move that President Obama himself made when he was still a candidate in his very famous and highly lauded speech on race that he made when he was running against Hillary Clinton, and at that time still John McCain, right? I mean, even then, he drew a parallel between a kind of radical black nationalist position and a radical racist position. And so all that to say that there's been an effort to try to stake out so-called middle ground in America, particularly on the question of race, that has been deeply invested in trying to make it seem as if responses to racism that are too radical or too progressive or too much inflected with specific racial claims are just the same as people who might be members of neo-Nazi groups or the Ku Klux Klan. And the difficulty now in this moment is that it actually raises the fact that a mainstream or centrist position is not that effective at removing the most vitriolic racism from American public life. You can't simply just open spaces for free speech or believe as though that all positions on a side or a given issue are the same, which has been a real watchword, I think, of the way that we've approached these issues historically, and be able to prevent the kinds of hatred that we saw on display in Charlottesville over the weekend. So the president's comments, in spite of them being relatively tone-deaf and consistent with some of the tone-deafness that the president has displayed on a whole host of issues, it actually is more common than not to see that kind of equivocation in the face of these overt racist displays.
On 88.1 WYPR, it's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Dr. Nathan Conley. He's on the history faculty at Johns Hopkins University. We're talking about the horrific events in Charlottesville, Virginia, that took place this past weekend. Dr. Conley, it seems that the president, both in his last week in his saber rattling with North Korea, and perhaps in his remarks on Saturday afternoon, that he is exclusively speaking to his base, that he is talking to these 62 million people who voted for him in November. It's about 38% of the electorate now who still evince support for him. And it seems that as long as he continues that conversation with just those people and excludes everybody else, that he has very little to worry about in terms of consequences. I mean, the outcry, you know, from even people and leaders in the Republican Party is now starting to gin up a little steam. But with the people who voted for him, and of course many of the people on the streets of Charlottesville, these neo-Nazis and Klansmen, profess to be some of those people. They are looking to hear moderation. They are looking to hear a sort of, you know, implicit acceptance of the kind of actions that they're taking.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, Donald Trump on this question is nothing if not consistent, right? I mean, he has rarely tried to speak in terms that, in fact, are centrist. And, I mean, again, even the on many sides comment, in spite of its centrism, is actually a kind of a break from the way he usually talks about, you know, these issues. I mean, he has been an unlikely candidate, now an unlikely, you know, successor to Obama. He was certainly seen by many to be an unlikely candidate for a second term in office, and yet and still, he's been able to occupy a pretty prominent position in American political life. And so what we're seeing from him is very much part of, you know, the Trump brand, frankly, in terms of who he believes he is speaking for and mobilizing. And you know, even if you look at the reactions to Trump's election immediately after in November, I mean, the sense of disbelief around him was precisely linked to the fact that he had not run a conventional campaign. And so, you know, I don't think that we should expect him now to be more of a statesman. I don't think we should believe that somehow his utterances on the race question will be in any way, shape, or form anything other than what they have been up to this point. And I think what it really does point to, as your own question illuminates, is that the Republican Party really has to make a hard decision about how far is too far in terms of what they're willing to accept. As you had mentioned yourself, you had a member of Trump's own administration, the CEO of Merck, Mr. Kenneth Frazier, who had basically decided that this weekend's comments were beyond the pale. And I think there are going to be a number of people, as this issue continues to escalate, who are going to have to make a similar kind of determination. When precisely does it make sense to abandon support for the president? Will there always be a sector of American society in the polity that endorses his brand of politics? Absolutely. Has he actually emboldened sectors of the political sphere that were already there relative to, you know, people who frequent the website Stormfront or this new kind of alt-right movement, also quite true. But I think it's also very important to think hard about the office of the presidency and to recognize that we have someone there who's not really that interested, even in a few kind of temporary appearances that seem to be bridge-building possibilities. He's not really that interested in building a kind of broad base of support or even crafting a broadly acceptable message.
And is that what's different? Because it does seem that there is a marked difference in tone and a marked difference in the fear and the horror that this these kinds of events initiate, which is to say, I mean, you know, Sarah Palin in 2008 and the Tea Party talked about taking our country back.
Right.
That's some of the rhetoric that we heard over the weekend. But there does seem to be an escalation. There does seem to be a deepening of the vitriol. I mean, what occurs to you in your assessment? What's different now than 10 years ago when it was Sarah Palin and the Tea Party?
Well, I would actually go even earlier than that in thinking about the candidacy of Ronald Reagan, right? So if you think about 1979, 1980, Reagan finally has seemed to break through and have the possibility to achieve, you know, national office, which he does, defeating Jimmy Carter. And, you know, he's able to launch his campaign at the Neshoba County Fair in Neshoba County, Mississippi, where the civil rights workers were killed during the 1960s. And he's very specific and intentional about trying to mobilize a kind of fringe of America that in an earlier period, again, just 20 years earlier, had been the epicenter of some of the most racist violence ever documented in the 20th century, right? And so, you know, there's a way in which the Republican Party was very effective at finding ways of bringing into the fold disaffected Southern Democrats who were frustrated with civil rights reform in the 1960s, who joined the Republican Party en masse in the late 60s and early 70s, people like Jesse Helms, people like Strom Thurmond, Helms from North Carolina, Thurmond from South Carolina. And these are people who became longtime Republicans. Again, you think about Trent Lott, Mississippi. And so all this to say the Republican Party's real North Star is there, it has been historically, their ability to use what they call dog whistle politics, right, where you hear it but you don't hear it on the question of race, to be able to use seemingly colorblind rhetoric. And one of the great Republican strategists of that period, a man by the name of Lee Atwater, was actually caught on tape being very explicit about the fact that you can use issues like taxes or busing to basically serve as proxies for concerns about black people or Hispanics. Again, we see this with immigration now. You know, so there is a definitive break, because even someone like Ronald Reagan, who used Neshoba County as a kind of launching pad for his campaign, would still make statements that tried to cast explicit racism as being on the margins. With Trump, there is a real break. I mean, it's certainly the case that after the presidency of Barack Obama, that really the surge of the Tea Party in 2010, the mobilization of people like Sarah Palin from obscure candidates in a place like Alaska, or coming from a place like Alaska to national prominence, was all about trying to respond to what was seemingly a breakthrough that most people did not want. I mean, Obama famously desegregated the American presidency, right? And so most people who were responding to the Tea Party in part were responding to these older forms of dog whistle politics, or reading, you know, the Constitution on the floor of the Congress and these kinds of things. Again, the opposition to health care. All of this was tinged with the racial question, but now it is indeed different. I mean, you have somebody like Steve Bannon, who is deeply embedded in the White House, who has a very clear record of, you know, neo-Nazi sympathies and documented, you know, background in creating websites and media outlets for very clear white nationalist politics. Someone like Jeff Sessions, who in the 1980s could not be appointed to the federal bench, now is the head of the Justice Department, right? That seemingly is acceptable. The assertion of Andrew Jackson as one of the great presidents in American history, and the kind of installation of his painting in the White House, even in full knowledge of what he did with Native Americans, his positions on slavery and so forth. All of these moments have been kind of winks and nods and steps in a direction that have been much more explicit than the dog whistle politics of old. And again, it really is a kind of come to Jesus moment for the GOP, because they, as much as they have talked about being the Party of Lincoln in historical terms. They really have to figure out now, you know, beyond this election cycle, beyond the next election cycle, what will be the long-term consequence of letting the kind of politics that they have kind of escape the Pandora's box.
Mm-hmm. One more quick question for you, and I know you're busy and you got to go, but when Mr. Trump during the campaign talked about the forgotten men and women of this country who will be forgotten no more, is it your assessment, your hunch, your understanding that those forgotten men and women, the kind of people that we saw on the streets of Charlottesville on Friday and Saturday, is that some of those forgotten men and women? Is that most of them? Is it a few of them? I mean, how severe is this thread of you know, vitriolic racism and anti-Semitism running through the sector of the electorate that still supports the president?
Right. Well, that language about the forgotten man is an old kind of, you know, populist talking point. So again, I think it's really important to keep in mind that you had, you know, earlier presidents, you know, people like Richard Nixon, who famously talked about the silent majority, and, you know, again, Reagan and even George W. Bush were very good at using kind of populist rhetoric about mobilizing people who were seemingly forgotten. And the question one always has to ask when you respond to these kinds of statements is forgotten by whom or forgotten by what? And in many instances, it's implied that the people who were forgotten by the civil rights reform was the white working class. The people who were forgotten by affirmative action were, again, everyday kind of poor whites. But I would implore your listeners to consider, again, the kinds of people who are descending on Charlottesville over the weekend are largely people who actually are pretty well-resourced, right? These are people who have the resources to travel to Charlottesville, who can basically engage in a public protest without concern about backlash on their place of employment. Many of Trump's supporters were entrepreneurs who owned their own businesses. The average salary for most of the people who voted for Trump, who were white men, was in excess of $70,000 a year, right? So it's on one level, I think, easy for us to consider this as a marginal sector of a forgotten class. It's another thing to think about people who have already been very well supported, very well resourced and protected by the system as it exists, and who are now fighting to make sure that that system remains very much in place. I think the crisis that you saw raised by Obama's presidency, certainly the crisis that you see raised by points about the demographic shifts in America and the browning of America, are causing a number of people who are actually quite well off to, one, make declarations about being forgotten, but two, to really dig in and try to fight for privileges that are quite substantial in many instances. So I think it's really important to think about the forgotten trope as exactly that, a kind of narrative meant to assert a certain kind of marginality that, in fact, is not really true.
Dr. Nathan Conley, he's the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University and the author of A World More Concrete, Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow South Florida, and the co-host of the history podcast, Backstory. Dr. Conley, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up after a break, a status report on Baltimore Link, the new bus system here in Charm City. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.